Hello and welcome to A Hurler's Life with me, Brian Carroll. In this podcast, we chat with former greats of the game about their hurling lives. From the best manager they played under, to the one win that means the most to them. In every show, the guests will reveal the best six they ever hurled with. Alan Kearns from Clarenbridge in Galway joins me in this week's show. Alan was a brilliantly talented hurler and footballer, winning Club All-Irelands with his native Clarenbridge in 2011 and his adopted football club, Salt Hill Knocknacarra in 2006. He won three National Hurling Leagues with Galway throughout a career that spanned from 1997 to 2011, while he also won a Football All-Ireland with Galway in 2001. His selfless charity work has seen tens of millions raised for his Alan Kearns projects. This is A Hurler's Life with Alan Kearns. A Hurler's Life is proudly sponsored by Golan Bake. Golan Bake is the home of the jambon, and you can buy their products in the supermarket freezer aisle to bake at home. Their range includes the nation's favourite, the ham and cheese jambon, as well as their new pepperoni pizza jambon and chicken fajita jambon flavours. Hurling and jambons, only in Ireland.
Alan, I'm absolutely delighted to have you on the line. Great to have someone from the West. You had a hugely eventful career, played hurling and football for Galway. Hurling career, particularly in the hurling, although you did win an All-Ireland with Galway in the football. But I'm going to start with one of the probably more controversial couple of years that you had. Ger Lucknan came in to much furore as manager of Galway, obviously having been previously managed Clare to win the All-Ireland on a couple of occasions. And it was a very interesting couple of years, let's put it that way. And he brought his famous training regime. I heard rumours about you training in the race course in Galway.
Well, it wasn't the race course in Galway. It was there was definitely a Gallops in Tubborough, right, where we trained one winter. It was close to Auschwitz type setup. And it was a running. It was really hard running in a Gallops in Tubborough. Pookie Connors is Gallops there in Tubborough, and it was hard going. It was deep sand as well. But we got fit, and we lost a lot of weight, and it was definitely eventful, and it was just tough. Now, and I think his aim there was to really break us down and then build us back up and see what we're made of mentally, to see what kind of steel was there, and to try to weed out the men for the boys in terms of a real, real intense and tough kind of boot camp, nearly like the thing you see on television there with the Rangers in recently, what it's called again, Hell Week, is it?
Yeah.
It was definitely a hell few months, but it was, I came out of it really well. I was probably never as fit after that couple of months, but it probably did take a toll on others, you know. But yeah, it was, you know, he brought huge enthusiasm, huge passion, he brought a good team with him. It was a very eventful 2 years. We probably didn't reach what we probably should have, the success we should have attained. I think the first year, what happened, we lost to Clare and we lost to Kilkenny. And the second year then, we lost in the quarterfinal to Cork when Joe Canning announced his arrival in Thurles that famous day in 2008. He scored 2-12 on the rock. So we didn't, like, he came in too much furore and much hype and much anticipation, but unfortunately, I suppose, for whatever reason, the success didn't follow that he had in Clare.
That game against Clare in Ennis, probably the most eventful thing out of that was the fact that he didn't name the team until you were out in the field doing your warm-up.
Yeah, that's true. I think we played Laois the week before, and we were heading to Clare, and obviously Ger was heading back to his native Ennis and his native Clare. So it was a really, really much hyped event. And the thought process behind that was that everybody should be ready, that if people were named on the team on the Tuesday or Thursday, they'd often drop the heads and probably not be as up for the game. So we wanted everybody to be really, really up for the game. And I think the team was supposed to be announced in the hotel. But for whatever reason, the team wasn't announced until just before the parade, and which was, I suppose, a bit off-putting for a lot of people. Nobody knows where we stood. But we still probably underperformed a little bit that day. We were quite close enough to beating Clare that day. There was whole famous incidents about them shortening the pitch and tightening the pitch, and there's all sorts of rumours going on about the pitch. I think was definitely pulled in a little bit. But Yeah, no, we were beaten that day, which was very, very disappointing. And then we moved on to play Kilkenny, and a few late Eddie Brennan goals cost us that day as well in Croke Park. Probably one of my better days that day. I was marking JJ. I think I got 4 points off from playing wing forward, but I was moved out midfield then to mark Cha, to follow Cha, and I kind of got lost out there and trying to follow him and mark him, and probably my own focus on my own game was gone, and I had a very poor second half then. And we eventually lost to Kilkenny. I think Eddie Brennan got a couple of late goals. He was left an acres of space on his own, I think nearly half the pitch on his own at one stage, and the ball broke into him and he stuck it in. And that was the beginning of our downfall that day.
You mentioned going off to mark Cha. It can be very different as a forward to try and go out and mark another midfielder that maybe is roving up the field. It's a different type of mindset.
Oh, yeah, because you're going into a nullifying rather than an expressive mindset, if you know what I mean. So I was after scoring 4 points, I think, that day in the first half of JJ, and it was going really well. And then you moved out midfield, and you're probably, because you're going so well, to try and mark, to try and, I think Chad was going really well that day as well. And then you're switching to become a negative, to become a marker, and you're just following him, and you're not focused on the ball or your own game, and you're just trying to stop him. And he was on the top of his game that day. He was, you know, he was a brilliant midfielder, and I just went totally out of the game, and I don't think he hit a ball in the second half, to be honest with you. But it's a totally different mindset. As I said, you go from a negative mind, a positive expressive mindset to a negative nullifying defender type mindset, and you're not focusing on playing the game, just focus on stopping a player.
In 2008, you mentioned that game in Turles. Big game, you know, Joe Canning announced his arrival, as you said, but Cork just found a way to win that game. You know, Don Logue was sent off for actually pulling you down. You'd scored a goal, but it was brought back for a penalty.
Yeah, and like I do a lot of work in Africa, you know, in charity, and Don Logue was in Zambia with us a few times, and on several occasions, and I was obviously good friends with him, and he actually pulled me down, but the goal was scored and the goal was disallowed, and that's why I was raging, because as you know, as a forward yourself, Brian, you know, you always want to score and you want the goal to stand. But he was sent off for pulling me down. We were given a penalty, and I think Joe took it and Joe stuck it. And Joe was on fire that day. I shouldn't have played that day, actually, because I spent 2 nights in Ina Hospital the previous weekend. Where I was knocked out. We went down to Turles for a training day, a dry run on the Saturday, and we played a little bit of a game at the end of the session, and I was taken clean out by, I think, Andy Carey, Kemp blindsided me, and I was knocked unconscious for a couple of minutes, and it was a really, really hot day, and I was carted off an ambulance to hospital, and I spent 2 nights in Nina. But back then, I suppose there was no such thing as concussion protocols or back to play protocols, whatever they're called. So I think Ger persuaded the medical team to pass me fit. And but I was nowhere near ready to play that day or fit. I'm looking back on it, I'm still half woozy. And you know, I had a poor game. I was taken off, I think, but from what I can remember of the game, was Canning was sensational. Probably the rest of us didn't give him enough help, you know. And Cork were down to 14 men pretty early. I think it was midway through the first half that penalty was given, and you know, they just got on top of it in the second half and dominated it totally and got huge momentum, and we just couldn't revert, even on the back of Canning's stunning performance.
You played in two All-Irelands in 2001 against Tipperary, the Beachy, 218 to 215, and then Cork Beachy in 2005, then 116 to 121. You know, you got to play on the biggest day in September, but unfortunately you were on the losing side on both occasions.
Yeah, huge regrets, obviously, not to have won a hurling medal. And given the team and talent we have, we definitely were really underachievers. And I suppose there's loads of reasons for that, but they were devastating. Like, it's nothing worse than waking up on a Sunday, on a Monday morning, and you're probably hungover, and you probably even don't sleep. To be honest, I remember the first one, I didn't sleep, or second one, especially the first one, because where I was going for the double that year, I was in the football final 2 weeks later, and we won that. We beat Meath, and you had a chance to make history, I suppose, in terms of matching what Teddy McCarthy did. And the second one against Cork, I remember just tossing and turning the room, looking at the ceiling, and just the knot in the stomach is awful. And you wake up that following morning, and the bus journey home is, you know, you're really appreciative of the people coming out supporting you, but it's the last place on earth you want to be, going up on stage, because because I suppose you feel you've let people down, you let family down, and it's your lifetime goal has been, you've come up short again in terms of as a collective. And it's just, it's really, really, you know, for the following weeks and months into the winter, it's a hard one to get over.
That's a very valid point, because you understand that people mean well, but you really don't want to meet people the day after in All-Ireland. You know, you literally want to crawl into a shell. And, you know, I obviously have an experience with the county, but I did with my club. And, you know, people mean well, but it's a very, very tough place, and it's a lonely place.
It is a very lonely place, and you probably just want to just bury your hand in a quiet pub and spend the time with the players to kind of process it, get over it, probably do the post-mortem, whatever goes on, because there's always post-mortems, and they're the worst as well. I hate post-mortems, but, you know, the people do mean well. They want to support and help you through it, but, you know, you don't want to be there, really. You only want to be there if you're up winning and celebrating, and, you know, such a difference between a winning and losing dressing room. And I never forget that. I think the two nights we were in, was it the City West? And I'll never forget that room. Jeez, looking up the ceiling all night, just what ifs and what could have been. And it's you know, it is a huge regret, I suppose. One of my biggest regret that I don't have. You know, I've won a club All-Ireland football with Saltill and a senior one with Galway and a club with Clarenbridge. And the hurling one was the one that would have, you know, really completed the set, the big four, and you know, to got so close twice. And probably we didn't really, you know, looking back on the hurling career, we really, really underachieved as a collective, as a county, for many, many years. It's unbelievable players, and we'll probably talk about a few of them later. It was heartbreaking, really.
Well, taking away from our heartbreak, and we'll try and concentrate on some better days, I'd like for you then to maybe tell us about the one win that would mean the most to you.
The one win that definitely, in my hurling career anyway, the one would be definitely the club All-Ireland McLarenbridge in 2011. We were flittering away for 10 years, but, you know, we won our first ever club title in 2001, and we went on to the All-Ireland and was played in Thurles that year because Croke Park was being renovated, and the Great Bird team hammered us in the All-Ireland final, the Wheelhans, and you know them too well, Brian. That great Bird team. And then for the next 10 years we probably weren't as united as a club, or as we weren't, you know, as committed. But that said, the great Portumna team, the great Sarsfield team, and the great Athenry team were dominating that era as well. So we thought we'd never win Anthony again, to be honest. Yeah, we were getting to semi-finals or quarter-finals, and Portumna or somebody would beat us. And then in 2010, Micheál Donoghue took over, and he changed a lot of what we did in terms of the standards we expected of ourselves, the standard us as senior players were, you know, looking back at my own career, one of the disappointments, I suppose. You know, it took me till Micheál took over to realise that I should have been a lot better leader with my club, and I should have been a lot better club man. And he demanded that of me. And that's a huge regret I would have had, that I probably wasn't as committed to the club as I should have been for a lot of years, part due to football, part due to Africa. But Micheál really demanded a lot more of me and made me demand more of myself, which was why he's such a great manager. And, you know, we went down that year and we had an unbelievable roller coaster year. We probably shouldn't have got out of the group. We got out of the group by score difference. We lost our first two games. We beat Climadady well, and we drew with Bath to get through into a preliminary quarter final. And then we had the summer off and we went on a roller. We just went on a run then, and we were lucky to get over the county final. We went to a replay and went to an extra time in the replay with Loch Ray. And I suppose a funny one there is the last time that happened, my dad was captain of Ardrahan when the last county final to go to a replay, an extra time in the replay. My dad won a county title with his own club, Ardrahan. But anyway, we went down then to beat De La Salle, and probably one of the journalists and the experts say that the pundits say was probably one of the best club games of all time, where we beat De La Salle in a cracker. And then we beat O'Loughlin Gales in the All-Ireland final. And the reason that's so sweet is obviously it's an All-Ireland final with my club and my friends and my family. My brother was playing. But another reason it's so sweet is because I suppose I was 34 and I knew the end was near. So I could appreciate it so much more and savour it so much more. and realize how much of an achievement it was for a small club to do such a thing. And I you know, when you're younger, you think it's never going to end. But I realized the next year or two could be my last, and I was unlikely ever to reach Croke Park ever again. With my friends and my family, and to experience such joy, I suppose, and also to see the joy it brought to the village was unbelievable, to the older people, to the sick people, and you know how it was in the middle of the recession in 2011 too. Times were tough, and there was no recession in Clarenbridge that March, let me tell you. So, but yeah, it has to be the club of Ireland.
Brilliant. You obviously mentioned, you know, you played club football in particular with Salthill and Knocktacara. How did you actually juggle that? And even how did you come to play football with them?
So I suppose where I'm from, Clarenbridge, there's no football. And South Galway and East Galway is all hurling. And then West Galway, which is Connemara, and North Galway, Tuam and Currafin, it's all football. There's very little hurling out there. So it's kind of a divided county. So I studied physiotherapy in Trinity College, and when I went to Trinity for the first years, I was hurling away with them, and I was playing actually a lot of soccer back in Galway. I was playing Oscar Trainer for Galway. I was playing for Galway Town, and I was asked him with Galway United, but I didn't go in because I was living in Dublin to train with them. But the hurling wasn't the standard, wasn't hectic, as you can imagine. Hurling, you know, Trinity is very much renowned for its, I suppose, cricket and rugby and rowing, and it wouldn't be renowned for being strong GA college.
But they have, you know, certainly improved over the last year and a year or two.
They've hugely improved, and you know, we had a good bunch of players, but I was living with a couple of cabin guys, and they were playing county football, and they had a very good setup, and their training was very professional and very good. So they said, come out training with us for the winter and keep fit for the winter. So without training, that's what I did. So without training, I was 23 when I took it up, I think. So without training with them, and I was loving it, I enjoyed it. And they stuck me in corner back for a few games because I was to do a man marking job, because I was lucky enough to have a little bit of speed, and so that's what I did. So they put me in as a man marker for a few games, and then moved me up to wing back. And then I enjoyed it so much, I said I might as well join a club in Galway. So I approached a few clubs because some of the clubs I couldn't play with, because they had hurling clubs with them. They were both hurling and football clubs. So I could only join a non-hurling club. So Salthill was the closest senior club to me that were willing to accept me. I joined Salthill in 2000. I was playing Sigerson then in 2000, 2001, and John O'Mahony had heard or spotted me or heard somebody, so he asked me to join them in 2001. Actually, they'd lost the league final, so I joined them in May 2001, and we won that Ireland in 3 months later or 4 months later. So it was very lucky now, and I must thank O'Mahony. He really took a punt to me, but it was like little did I think, if you told me that I was going to win a football All Ireland and a club football All Ireland before everyone anything with hurling, I had thought you were smoking something.
And how did, like, your August or maybe September, October, how did you manage that between club and hurling and football?
I actually, you know, it's all the haze when I look back on it. But it does affect you, really, you know, especially that summer. I performed okay, but I didn't perform that well in the hurling final. But there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of pulling and dragging from the managers and from the county boards. And the biggest problem was the mental pressure you felt trying to please both managers and both squads. And then you had a bit of biting in the squads, some of the squads, people, especially because I was starting on both for all of it nearly. And then you're only there half the time. And O'Mahony was a lot more accommodating on the hurling side, because obviously I was a hurler through and through, and John just allowed me to do the football drills. So, but there was a lot of pressure from both in terms of, you know, where I should be and why I should be, especially during as the summer ramped up and into the quarter. That year, the football was, we went to the back door as well, which added a lot more games. So it was very challenging, more mentally than physically. And when you look back at it now, you know, you're young, you think you can do it all, but it does really affect you. You know, it's probably impossible to do it. even back then when it wasn't as professional as it is now, or as demanding it is now. But you're back then, you're full of bravado and full of adrenaline. You think you can do it all.
You mentioned that obviously Portumna and Loughrea had brilliant teams through the mid-noughties, and there was a massive rival there that sometimes spilled out of control. And a lot of people looking in from the outside reckon that the club rivalry in Galway can be toxic. You know, what's your experience of that? And you know, by all accounts, it's improved over the years, but from what you saw firsthand?
You know, I think that was probably used as an excuse more than it is valid, if you know what I mean. I just think, you know, as a group of players, looking back on teams that were successful and looking back on club and county, I just think, and it's a regret of mine, that we probably weren't as demanding or as, you know, we probably accepted mediocrity a little bit too much of ourselves and of the management and of the county board, and we weren't demanding of the highest of standards. That was my vision and or my view. I could be totally wrong from others, but I mean, look at the great teams. They just do not accept mediocrity, like from each other, and from the management and from the administration. And you know, look at the football, the Donnellan, the Joyce, these guys. They just would not tolerate any mediocrity of any player or any manager. And if it was, you know, you were told about it, and you had those honest, difficult conversations. But maybe I'm being harsh, but maybe from the hurling side, we might have been a little bit too nice to each other or to the management, especially on ourselves. And that was probably the problem more than the toxicity of the clubs.
Very interesting. You've had some serious managers over the years. Who would you rate as the best manager you've ever played under?
In the hurling, definitely Micheál Donoghue from our club. And I knew he'd win an All-Ireland when he went in with Galway. Because what he brought was, Micheál is a brilliant manager. First of all, he knows when to really, really challenge you hard, but he also knows when to put the hand around the shoulder, and are the different players, he treats them all differently in terms of their personalities. He demand, like when he came in with our club first, he got us five or six of the senior players, and he, you know, he really called us out on our lack of leadership and our lack of on what we could bring, and he really empowered us to become proper leaders. And then his main philosophy is that players must drive it, the players must self-police, and the players must drive the standards internally. So if, for example, if anyone is lagging a train, it's up to me to challenge them and call them out. And that brings everybody with you then. It's far more powerful than the players calling each other out than the manager shouting at you. And so that took a bit of time to work into the Clarenbridge system, but it definitely brought us places. He's a very good trainer, very good tactician, but he's ruthless as well, like ruthless in his focus, ruthless in his preparation, but also ruthless in terms of when the big decisions need to be made, he will make them. But he also, you know, funnily, it's contrary to that, he's a very good players man, where he'd meet you for coffees, make sure your own life is in good order, looks after you off field, as well as being a very good astute, very good tactician, and also very good in the line, very calm on the line, makes good changes when they need to be made. So without doubt, he would be the best manager in from a hurling context that I played under.
Alan, you mentioned your regret of not winning the All-Irelands, but you know, would you count that then as the biggest regret about your hurling career, or would you have more?
Yeah, I would have a couple of regrets, I suppose. You know, looking back, I suppose I probably was a little bit too nice on occasions with, you know, managers and with the hurling and football situation. And I said that then, and I probably was too nice in the field as well, a little bit. I wasn't ruthless or tunnel vision enough at times, where, you know, I probably had a lot going on with the charity and football and hurling and other stuff, and I probably needed to narrow the focus a little bit, but I wasn't ruthless enough to narrow that focus. You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Where I was maybe trying to do too much, and maybe I didn't max out my potential, and maybe people perceived that I wasn't as committed. I'm not sure, you'll have to ask people what they thought, but I don't know. But yeah, that'd be one regret. I thought maybe I was too nice in the field at times as well. I wasn't. And Gerard Mann even called me out and he said I was too nice. And he's probably right. You know, I probably was too nice, and maybe took me a while to really make me demand more of myself when he came in as a manager in 2010, 2011. And you know, I had a probably my best year ever for the club, and probably in hurling in terms of performance wise. And in when I was 34, 211 with 210, 211 with Clarenbridge, and I suppose I was brought back into the county panel after being gone for 3 years after that. So yeah, big regret would be not having won the All-Ireland and not having completed the set of four, you know what I mean, the big four, and hurling being my first love. Another regret would be not being probably ruthless enough. You know, at high level sport, you need to be ruthless and tunnel visioned in terms of to get to the very, very top. And I probably wasn't as ruthless or tunnel visioned enough to max out on maybe what I've kept. Maybe I did. Maybe I don't know. Maybe the way I was going was the best way for me to do it. But you know, sometimes you think if you focused a lot more on just the one sport, or you didn't have the charity going on, or you didn't have other sports, golf or soccer, whatever, what could you have achieved, you know?
You were nominated for an All-Star on numerous occasions, but you never actually won one. Did that bother you?
Yeah, I suppose it's not as much now, but you know, it would have been nice to win one. It would have been nice to win one, definitely. And it's kind of always nice to be. It's a nice personal honour, but you know, I wouldn't trade the club or the club All-Irelands for the All-Irelands for one. But you know, I suppose it's just your own, the sign of your own achievement that I think every player would love one, wouldn't they? You know, and they'd lie, and you know,
you're lying if you say otherwise.
You're lying if you say otherwise, yeah, because you're not, you know, it's one of the top accolades you can get. I was nominated, I think, 6 or 7 times, but very close on a couple of occasions, but I wasn't chosen, unfortunately.
You mentioned that obviously you trained as a physio initially in Trinity, and you've gone on to do fantastic work with Self Help Africa and Alan Kearns projects. But how has hurling influenced your career or job choices through the years?
Yeah, I suppose I went into physio. I think I remember I went to school in St. Mary's in Galway, and the first time I ever experienced a physiotherapist was we beat St. Kieran's in the All-Ireland College semi-final after extra time, and I was crippled after with cramps or whatever. So we were playing North Mon in the All-Ireland final the week later. We were beaten in it. But I remember that school sent me for physio regularly that week, and I just thought, geez, that's a cool job to be involved with sports people and getting sports people back. So I just put that down. You know, I thought that was what I would like. So that's what triggered a career in physiotherapy for several years. And then I suppose physiotherapy led me to Trinity, which probably led me to football. Yeah. And then physiotherapy also led me to Africa, where I volunteered to work with an Irish nun, who you know well, Brian, Sister Cathy Crawford from Leash. And I volunteered to work with her for 3 months in 2005. And I suppose that changed my whole philosophy in life and my whole career, where I came back really with a different outlook on life, a different perspective, different values, different priorities. And I just went about to raise a few pounds for her. And organically, you know, that 5 grand became 50 grand, became 500 grand, became, you know, several million later, where I had to set up a legal structure to run, to manage that money transparently. So I went at that full time. But without the GAA, as you know, Brian, without the GAA and the hurling, there's no way I would have raised the amount of money that I've raised. And even if you look at the Do It For Dan at the moment, it's amazing what the GAA are doing there in terms of raising, you know, nearly 2 million for that wonderful brave boy. But similarly, the GAA, you know, when the Alan Kearns project was really strong, they brought in millions. Yeah, I think we've raised 20 million between different projects and different entities. But it's largely due to the influence of hurling and the community of the GAA, the wonderful community of the GAAs. So that's had a huge influence.
I've obviously, as you said, have been to Africa with you and very grateful for that. And yes, you come home a different person and you've much more, you know, humility and respect for things in your life. But for most of us, we eventually get back into the normality of life in Ireland. For you though, you didn't allow that to happen. Why do you think that is?
I suppose I spent 3 months there. I you know, I was just inspired by Kathy, the Irish nun, in terms of she was in her 70s. She was, you know, sacrificed everything for the community that she was living with, her own dreams, her own future, her own family. And she was a 60 in her mid-60s at the time. And she was dragging a community by herself, building houses, sinking wells, you know, looking after 75 or 80 kids who were severely disabled, who would be left in the sand to die if she wasn't there. And here I was, you know, had a little bit of profile from the GA. What was I doing? What difference was I making in the world, you know? And I just came back to tell her story, really. And another nun sister, Mary Maloney from Tip, who was running an orphanage with 200 kids. And she had a school. She started off with a school under a tree. And now she had, you know, thousands of kids in a school that were all orphaned or vulnerable. And these were two Irish women, you know, elderly Irish women who were, in my eyes, the real heroes of life. And I just came back. I said, these women's story, they were short of funds. They were struggling badly. And I said, their story needs to be told, however way we're going to tell it, and they need to be helped. And it was through the GAA, through the media in the GAA, who were very good to me as well, and the profile that the GAA brought to the projects, that it just snowballed. You know, to be honest with you, I just had an intention of raising €5,000 for her to sink a well for water, because there was a famine there at the time. And we got to the All-Ireland final. I was there in 2005 in January and February. We got to the 2000 final that we talked about against Cork in 2005. And that brought a huge amount of profile to the fundraising, and it just snowballed from there. And I got to a stage where I suppose I had to stay at it then, because there was so much money in there and we were getting so much support that I couldn't back down from it then. And I knew the difference that the money was making. I'd seen it. I saw the impact it was having. And I suppose I couldn't back down then from it.
And to be able to go full time, there must have been wrestling with your conscience to go do that at the same time.
Yeah, because I suppose I had my own career, it did have a big impact on my sporting career as well, because, you know, I was dropped from the hurling squad in 2008 because of the charity, and I was told that to my face, you know, in terms of the thought it was too big, I was too distracted by it, and I was. You know, hurling wasn't number one or whatever. And, you know, that was tough. But, you know, life and people's lives are more important than sports. But it was, yeah, you're sacrificing your physiotherapy career. But you know what? I was really passionate about it. I was hugely, hugely passionate about it. And I was blown away, as I said, by the kids the Cheshire Home for Disabled Children. You know, and I just couldn't get out of my head. One of the big things that really was stuck at me was, you know, here, these kids have the same dreams as me to become a sports star, a doctor, a nurse, or whatever. But by pure fluke of where I was born, I had every chance of becoming what I wanted to become if I wanted to take that chance. But they hadn't. They were struggling to put food in their mouth. And why was that? You know, why was I born here and they were born there? And how lucky am I to have all these opportunities? And I just wanted to provide those kids with those same opportunities if we could, you know, in some way, shape, or form, be it through school, be it through education, be it through just providing them with the basics of food and water. You know, as you saw the kids in the home, a lot of them, you know, make very good recoveries when they get the proper surgical and medical and physiotherapy intervention, and they come in, you know, not having walked ever, and they leave at the end of the term, but come back to school in a pair of shoes, and it makes such a big difference in their lives. So I just couldn't get away from it. I could not do it, if you know what I mean. It was having such an impact on me, and such a positive impact on some people in Ireland as well, but also more importantly, the kids that we were helping, it was having a huge impact on them.
Have you learned how to compartmentalize it so that when you're at home in Ireland with your family, with your wife, you know, that it's okay to lead a normal life here?
Yeah, I have now. So in 2015, we partnered with Self of Africa. I suppose I got burnt out, but obviously, you know, when the recession came in 2008, you know, Africa, it was very challenging to raise money for Africa. So, you know, I had to work 10 times harder for 10 times less. But we kept raising the same amount of money every year, but it was a real, real hard slog. And I was only myself, and we had a great board, and had a part-time person in the office, and a few brilliant volunteers. And I just got burnt out, and I got married in 2012, and I wasn't financially secure myself. You know, I had no savings, no pension, you know. I suppose I sacrificed my own career, both sporting and probably professionally. And then in 2015, my firstborn son, Ruan, was born, and he was critically ill for the first 6 months of his life, where he spent 3 months in Manchester, 3 months in Temple Street, who were amazing. And then he had life-saving surgery in Manchester. So that really, you know, brought me back home in terms of I needed to be at home now, and I needed to be with the kids. Africa, I was traveling a lot. I was away a lot at fundraisers in America, getting donors on board. Then I was in Africa regularly on project visits and site visits. So, you know, I needed to look after my family, my wife and my kids, and I needed to provide security for them. So that really helps you compartmentalize it pretty quickly. You know, that was a really, really challenging 4 or 5 months where you didn't know how he was going to live or die. And, you know, everything stopped. But I'm very grateful to Self of Africa, who've taken over the mantle for me, and Paul Glynn in particular, a businessman in Galway. He really drove the project for the last number of years with the backing of Self of Africa. You know, and when I did a strategic review of the organization, you know, for the long-term sustainability of the project, it needed to be under a bigger team. It needed to be under for their safety, it needed to be under a team that was going to, if anything happened to me or one or two others, then the projects would have been in danger of not continuing. But now their lifespan and their security is secure forever because of the backing Self of Africa are giving it.
Brilliant. You mentioned obviously that your son Ruan was very, very sick. Obviously extremely tough times. Did it ever force you to question the fairness of this, you know, all the good work you're doing for people, and that this struggle and real life and death situation came to your doorstep?
Yeah, I would have a good faith, and I'd be very spiritual as well. And I've kind of learned to accept things, and things happen for a reason. But I won't lie to you, I did in the depths of it, when he was really low and really touch and go, in particular the one day in Manchester where he was critically ill and his line got blocked and we didn't know whether he would make it. They needed to put another line in to keep him alive, but they couldn't get the needles in, and they were torturing for hours with needles, and it was a rough day. And I did question it there, where I said, look at Jesus, all the kids I've helped in a selfish way, you do ask that question. Yeah. Why is this, you know, after all the good that we have done through the organization, why were we landed with this challenge, not a burden but a challenge, in terms of him being so critically ill for so long. Like he was born on our wedding anniversary, so we thought it was a great start. But in December, we didn't get home till May, I think. But they were fleeting moments. You were so focused on just, you know, we couldn't control his health or his recovery. We just had to put trust and faith in the doctors, who were unbelievable, and the nurses. So all we could control was, all I could do was, you know, bring back the old sporting. The old sporting analogies, control the controllables. All I controlled was looking after Kira, who was, you know, obviously very anxious, but also looking after, trying to be the best mum and dad for Ruan, and trying to just be as normal as possible around him, and just love him as much as we could, and be as normal and play with, try and make him laugh, even though he had loads of wires and he had loads of needles, and he was being, you know, his heels were picked every half an hour for months. And he had loads of surgeries, but, you know, he made an unbelievable, miraculous recovery. So, and he's fully healthy today. But yeah, you do question it at times, but again, you just kind of focus on what you can control, and try and control your own anxiety and your own resilience, and practice what you preach, really.
Brilliant, Alan, and thank you so much for your honesty there. Aside from hurling and aside from your charity work, is there anything else you have a passion for?
Yeah, I suppose this lockdown is forcing everybody to reflect on their passions. I love golf. I love all sports. I love golf. And I played a lot of high level golf. Played a lot of, you know, soccer. I love soccer. I love squash, badminton, anything that you can compete with people. You know, I'm not a great man for the old running or the gym, but I love kind of play or the 5-a-side soccer. So I love playing, you know, active sports. I play a bit of the accordion as well. I love music. So I'm back practicing. I got the old accordion out of the box there the last few weeks, and I've been trying to learn a few tunes. We're actually going to bring a band to Africa next year, where we're going to bring several musicians from GAA and from musical backgrounds and do a tour of Zambia and Kenya. So that's what I'm working on at the moment, trying to put that band together and trying to scrub up a few tunes that I can join in every now and then with them. But yeah, I love playing the accordion. I'm really finding it, you know, enjoyable.
How did you get into that?
Would you believe we had an unbelievable national school? Michael Brown, Arena Brown, they had a really holistic approach to education. So even when back in the 80s, when I was in primary school, they were, you know, he was a brilliant coach. He really started Clare Bridges, an intermediate or junior club, when he came to the school. But he really produced, he coached us every day. And he was the found, he brought us, we won everything underage. My dad himself and Stephen Cohn were selectors with us. We won everything underage all the way up. And we eventually won intermediate and became senior. So that school was really a nursery for hurling. But his wife was big time into music and dancing, so we all used to do set dancing, and we all and Irish traditional dancing. We all competed in different, you know, all the championships, the kind of Connacht and the Worlds and stuff. And every Christmas we did a play, and we acted, and we all could play a musical instrument. And then they brought us in, and also, would you believe, they brought us carol singing every Christmas. So that's where the philanthropic or the charity element was the seed was sown there with me as well in that. And we used to go up to the elderly and help the elderly, and it was all about active citizenship and community engagement, sport, music, and then education as well was weaved in amongst it all. So they really had a holistic approach, it wasn't just about education, it was developing the kid as a whole. And they were miles ahead of the time. They even had science and computers in back in the 80s. They even did French exchanges, you know, back then to kind of give the sixth class a little bit of a step up before they went into secondary school. So we were very lucky with the primary school teach setup that we had, you know, in terms of developing us and introducing different passions to us and different hobbies as a very young age.
It strikes me as you're saying that, you know, you're living proof of the fact that you can achieve many things in your life and education and sport and all those things at once. You can really aspire to that and achieve. It doesn't have to be one or the other. And as I said, you're living proof. You went on to study at a very high level as well and play at a high level. So fantastic.
Yeah. And then look, I know you're a teacher, Brian, but, you know, I think that teachers can be hugely undervalued, because outside of your parents, and you know, you could have, you know, be looking after great parents or unlucky to have a dysfunctional family, which have a massive impact on your development and your self-esteem as a kid. But the next biggest influence, in my view, is your primary school environment and your secondary school, because that's when you're most impressionable. That's where, you know, great teachers are often, you know, seen to be huge mentors for people, or have changed the direction of people's lives because of the confidence or the skill that they've instilled in a kid. So I think it's a hugely undervalued and underpaid public position that should be valued a lot more by, you know, society, because they actually mould people for the future, you know.
Yes, for certain. We'll go back to hurling, Alan, and thank you so much for what you've shared with us so far. But back to hurling, and the big one for me, I'm now going to ask you to pick the best six players you've ever played with, and again, that's one from each line. So we'll start with your goalkeeper, please.
That I've ever played with.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you two. That's very hard to pick between. I'm going to Liam Dunne, who obviously was my club man, and played captain Galway in 2005 All Ireland final. We're in a tie with Colm Callanan, the current Galway, I think he's retired now as well, but they were two exceptional keepers. It's hard to pick between the two of them, because one's my club man and one was outstanding.
Oh, you're sitting on the fence.
I'll go with Liam, my club man. He'll kill me otherwise.
Add a push. Stick with the club. Right, yeah, very good. Who would you pick out of the full back line?
Oh, it's only one winner there, and Ollie Kenny. Yes. Absolutely sensational cornerback. You know, and he was a great forward as well. He played up front, but when I first started, he was a corner forward against Clare for 99, I think. And then he went back cornerback, but he was outstanding.
Outstanding, yes, certainly, as I know. And the half back line, who would you pick, Adam?
I'm gonna do a bit of the all star, be a bit cheating here. I'm going to stick in Michael Coleman. who played midfielder all his life, but he was a brilliant midfielder. But he often played centre back as well in some of our games. So I'm just going to, he's too good to leave out. So I'm going to stick him in the half back line.
Yeah, he went back centre back and managed a game. Yeah. Very tough, you know, left hand on top, but brilliant hurler.
Brilliant hurler.
So middle of the field. So if he's not there,
pick David Burke. Current Galway captain. So I played with him at this. He came in 2010. I came in 2011, and I played with him that year. He's exceptional.
Brilliant. The half forward line.
I'm going to go with Joe Cooney, one of the all time greats. You know, unbelievable vision. Such a gentleman off the field as well. But you know, probably the most gifted and unbelievable vision as well. And just he's such a creative player. Like he was fantastic. And he was the best man to give a pass as well. He'd always put it straight into your hand, you know.
Fantastic. So far you've Liam Donahue in goal, Ollie Canning, Michael Coleman, David Burke, the great Joe Cooney, and on the inside forward line, who would you pick?
Joe Canning.
No surprises there.
Yeah, that would have to be, you know, Colin Cannon, obviously a notable, and Kevin Broadwick, another one very hard to leave out there. Sensational player as well. So there's loads of great players that I was blessed to play with and learn from. So that's many more.
That's brilliant, Alan. Before you go, I have a little quick fire round.
Yeah.
So who is the best player in the game currently?
Joe or TJ, I'd say.
I have to stick you for one.
Gee, that's very hard to pick. You know, there's such two different players, but two brilliant players. Jamie Callanan's in there as well, and Parik, brilliant players. I should have to go to my own club, or my own county, Joe.
Brilliant. Okay. Who is the best player you ever played against? And you don't have to have marked him.
I'm going to go with Tommy Walsh. I marked him as well, so unfortunately. I just think he pound for pound, he was unbelievable. He could play in any position. He won Ulsters in every position early as well. And he was just brilliant. I just love watching him play as well.
Fantastic. Is it a hurl or a hurley?
Hurl.
Great choice. Hoops on your hurl or no hoops?
Hoops. Two. I select the old two and a half tin.
The little half one in as well.
Yeah. Depending on the weight, if you needed a little bit more weight. I used to love fixed hurls, actually. Fixed ones.
Yeah, interesting. What colour grip did you use?
Black, mainly.
Very good. Adidas World Cups or Puma Kings?
Oh, Adidas World Cups. Copa Mundial with all the Moldies. But World Cups, definitely in the winter.
Sweeper or no sweeper?
In the game?
Yeah.
I liked playing it, actually, because it's a nice role. I used to love playing sweeper, but no sweeper.
No sweeper. Why?
I just think it's a better game. There is no sweeper.
Okay, brilliant. Okay.
Sorry, it's more traditional as well.
Yeah.
It's more in the spirit or ethos of the game, you know, that there is none. But I know why people do it. And I'm in coaching myself, so I know we do use it. So I'm a bit of a hypocrite there.
O'Neill Slithers or Cummins All-Stars?
Cummins All-Stars. Just think they were nicer. They're more compact and more solid and more... They just felt nicer to me.
And last but not least...
I think they were a little bit thinner rims, weren't they, as well?
Yeah.
As far as I can remember, the O'Neills were a little bit thicker in the rim.
And last but not least, Alan, Croke Park or Thurles?
Oh, Croke Park. Thurles is an unbelievable pitch, but... Thurles, we've had horrendous defeats there, and then the journey home to Thurles is a nightmare to Galway. I've nightmares over some of the journeys home. So Croke Park, better memories there.
Brilliant, Alan. Thank you so much for your honesty. That was fantastic.
Right, thank you, Brian.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is sponsored by Golan Bake, and remember, Golan Bake is the home of the jambon, and you can buy their products in any supermarket to bake at home. If you haven't already, can you please subscribe to A Hurler's Life? We're on Twitter at A Hurler's Life, Instagram at A Hurler's Life, or you can email me at ahurlerslife@gmail.com.